J.J. Johnson on trombone with Concepts in Blue, the title track of his 1980 album. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead. And we see that the Trump administration is down by one, Nikki Haley, who was the U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, handed in her resignation today, effective at the end of the year. And we'll soon find out what that was all about. But I suspect, based on her temperament and her conduct from day one, that it has to do with the fact that she didn't feel that she was getting the respect that she deserved from the Trump administration, probably wanted a more high-profile position, whatever. But when I say her name and I chuckle, it's because the very first thing that she did when she was appointed was to basically throw down the gauntlet in the United Nations and told members of the UN that the U.S. was going to be watching how they're voting. And I remarked at the time, I said, she talks like she's got some brass knuckles in her purse. And she'd be calling people into the parking garage to have one-on-ones with them. That was the attitude that she had. So no love lost. But what I wanted to share with you today is an insider's view of the Brett Kavanaugh debacle. And it's important to pay attention to what is being said here. It's a long enough clip, but it does give some very important insights as to what was fueling Donald Trump's desire to ram this nomination through, no matter what. Our guide, our tour guide, is Senator from Rhode Island, Sheldon Whitehouse. And in this pretty substantial clip, he is explaining what happened behind the scenes, what the thinking was, what motivated this particular approach to a Supreme Court nomination, which by all accounts broke all the rules, with the president assuming basically, he was driving the FBI. He was the guy running the FBI. And he was the choreographer in chief of this whole process. By every means necessary, Brett Kavanaugh was to be appointed. Go beyond nomination to appointment. So let's hear from Senator Sheldon Whitehouse explaining Donald Trump's controversial nomination of Brett Kavanaugh to the nation's highest court.
Another warning sign was flashing. Senate Republicans were stopping at nothing to get this nominee through. Why? It made me wonder, why, behind all the shattered norms and traditions of the Senate, behind all the hidden documents and unanswered questions, stands the looming question, why? In my opening comments in the committee, I chronicled a pattern under Chief Justice Roberts, an unpleasant pattern. of 5-4 partisan rulings for the big corporate and special interests that are the lifeblood of the Republican Party. Not 3 or 4 times, not even a dozen or 2 dozen times, but 73 times. 73 times. All 5-4 partisan decisions, all wins for the big corporate and special interests that are the lifeblood of the Republican Party. 73 times. The pattern is clear in these 5-4 partisan decisions. Every time big corporate and Republican special interests are involved, the big interest wins. Every time. 73-0. On its way to delivering these Republican special interest victories, the Roberts Court, or I should say the 5 of them that do this, call it the Roberts 5, leaves a trail of wrecked precedents, a trail of sketchy, non-factual fact-finding, a trail of long-standing statutes ignored or rewritten, and a trail of supposedly conservative judicial principles like modesty, deference, originalism, and stare decisis, all violated. The pattern of these 73 partisan Roberts 5 decisions explains why big Republican interests want Kavanaugh on the court so badly, and why Republicans shredded so much Senate precedent to shove him through. The big Republican interests want to be able to pull 5-4 wins out of the United States Supreme Court as if it were a legislature they controlled. What are the areas of law where the big Republican corporate and special interests have a stake, where the Roberts Five delivered for those big Republican Party stakeholders? Well, first, they helped Republicans gerrymander elections. Veith v. Jubilee, 5-4. This was a big deal. It let Republicans gerrymander their way to control of Congress, to control of the House of Representatives, in a year Republicans lost by 1 million votes. They lost the House by 1 million votes and won it by gerrymander. The Roberts Five has helped Republicans keep minority voters away from the polls. Shelby County, 5-4. Bartlett v. Strickland, 5-4. Abbott v. Perez, 5-4. Making it harder to vote, harder for minorities or poor people or the elderly, is a Republican electioneering tactic. And Republican state legislatures went right to work passing voter suppression laws right after these partisan decisions. The Roberts Five also helped unleash big money political influence, giving big interests unlimited power to buy elections and threaten and bully Congress. McCutcheon and Bullock and the infamous, grotesque 5-4 Citizens United decision were their tools. This is the Sockdolager, the really big deal, by the way. There is a very small world of very big interests who have unlimited money to spend and a business strategy to spend it to influence politics. It's not a big group, but it's a powerful group, and it's the heart of the Republican funding machine. These few but big Republican interests were given unprecedented political artillery by the Roberts Five, at least unprecedented since Teddy Roosevelt cleaned house over a century ago. And our politics since Citizens United has been contorted and corrupted. But those big influencers are oh so happy. What else do the big influencers want? To get out of courtrooms. Big special interests that can muscle their way around Congress and capture executive agencies hate courtrooms. There's this annoying thing in courtrooms of being treated equally with regular people. There's this annoying thing in courtrooms about having to turn over your actual documents. There's this really annoying thing in courtrooms about having to tell the truth. So, bingo, the Roberts Five protected corporations from group class action lawsuits. Walmart v. Dukes, 5-4. Comcast, 5-4. Epic Systems, 5-4. And helped corporations steer customers and workers away from courtrooms and into corporate-friendly mandatory arbitration. Concepcion, Italian Colors, and Rent-A-Center, all 5-4 at the hands of the Roberts Five. What else? Of course, to bust unions. A perennial big business special interest classic, kind of a golden oldie for big Republican influencers. Harris v. Quinn, 5-4. Janice v. AFSCME, 5-4. And of course, to protect polluters. Big polluters pour big money into the Republican Party. They do this, they will tell you, to protect your freedom. They talk a lot about freedom. Turns out it's your freedom to breathe dirty air, drink dirty water, smell the river going by, eat chemicals with your food, and have climate havoc and acid oceans. It's all about freedom indeed. The freedom for big polluters to pollute for free and get away with it. And right with them there are the Roberts Five, over and over for the polluters, even stopping the nation's clean power plan 5-4 for the coal industry. The list goes on. It totals 73 partisan 5-4 decisions under Chief Justice Roberts, each giving big wins to big Republican interests. It is an indelible pattern. And although the American people might not be keeping exact score, they might not know that the number is 73, but they feel that the court is rigged. And the court is flying all the warning flags of a captured agency, dancing to special interest tunes and rampaging through precedent and principle to get there. This pattern is a disaster for the court. And I know Kavanaugh will contribute to that disaster. How do I know this? I know this because Kavanaugh's record tells me. That's why he's the nominee, after all. That's the why. He's been signaling the big influencers with over 50 speeches to the Federalist Society. I think he's got the human record for speeches to the Federalist Society signaling that he's their guy. And he's been signaling with his record. As a judge on the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals, in the most controversial and salient civil cases, those decided by bare 2-1 majorities, when Kavanaugh was in the majority with another Republican-appointed judge, He voted to advance the far right and corporate interest a striking 91% of the time. That's almost a perfect match for the Roberts 5 majority rulings in 5-4 cases where these conservative groups show up. Roberts 5 gives conservative groups a 92% win rate. Kavanaugh gives conservative groups a 91% win rate. No wonder he's their guy. 91%. Remember that number. Kavanaugh reliably voted for polluters and for dark money and for corporate interests with a healthy dollop of anti-choice, pro-gun, religious right politics thrown in. 91% is how he campaigned for this job. Big special interests have a habit of turning up regularly in appellate courtrooms like the D.C. Circuit. Their tool of influence is one of the worst policed tools of special interest influence in America, the so-called amicus brief, where big special interests fund front groups to file these amicus briefs to instruct courts how they want the courts to rule. They're called amicus briefs because you're supposedly appearing as a friend of the court. But this has nothing to do with friendship. It is a scandal of secrecy, deception, and manipulation. How does this involve Kavanaugh? In cases where conservative groups weighed in with these amicus briefs before him, Judge Kavanaugh sided with them, wait for it, 91% of the time. Again, 91%. Call him Judge 91%, and you understand why those big interests want him so badly on the Supreme Court, and why the Republican Party drove like drunk kids over the curbs and across the lawn, smashing mailboxes of procedure and propriety to get him there. The overlap between the groups in Kavanaugh's 91% club and the groups who fund Leonard Leo, the Federalist Society architect of Kavanaugh's nomination, is telling. The multi-million-dollar scorched earth ad campaign by groups like the Judicial Crisis Network is funded by big dark money interests. The NRA poured its own millions into campaigning for Kavanaugh. They promised NRA members that Kavanaugh will break the tie. They're 91% sure. In the face of all of this, Kavanaugh feigned impartiality. But then came the tell. When Kavanaugh returned to the Judiciary Committee to defend himself against accusations of a sex assault, his veneer of impartiality was pulled away. And we saw, America saw, the fierce and rabid conspiracy-mongering partisan within. His performance was recently described by a right-of-center columnist as his partisan, unhinged diatribe and non-judicial demeanor. I ask unanimous consent that the article from which I'm quoting be appended to the end of my remarks.
Without objection.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. He even blamed Bill and Hillary Clinton. Seriously. It shows where we are in this country that this display was not by itself disqualifying. But for the big special interests behind Judge 91%, This was not at all disqualifying. This was reassuring. This was great stuff. It just confirmed what they knew. Judge 91% would be their boy. The Roberts Five would get back in the saddle, and they'd get 73 more 5-4 partisan victories. But that moment gave the rest of the country the opportunity to take true measure of a man who claims he is impartial, a man who asks the United States Senate to grant him a lifetime seat in judgment of others and claims he will judge fairly. Fat chance. One longtime observer of the judiciary, who was an early supporter of Kavanaugh, recently withdrew his support. He wrote in the Atlantic magazine, "I cannot condone the partisanship, which was raw, undisguised, naked, and conspiratorial, from someone who asks for public faith as a dispassionate and impartial judicial actor. His performance was wholly inconsistent with the conduct we should expect from a member of the judiciary." Extraordinarily, even former Supreme Court Justice Stevens has warned against Kavanaugh for the same reason. Kavanaugh's raw, undisguised, naked, and conspiratorial partisan screed may have excited the donors, but it did nothing to address the concerns that had prompted the hearing in the first place. So, in addition to an epic fail of any reasonable test of impartiality, Judge Kavanaugh still bears credible allegations of sexual assault levied against him. I will confess, I believe Dr. Blasey Ford. We do have a big dispute here, but I hope that in this Senate we at least agree on one thing. If Dr. Blasey Ford's testimony was true, I hope we can all agree that Kavanaugh has no business on the court. Well, I believed her then, and I believe her now. And I did not find him credible at all. I found him belligerent and aggressive, just as his Yale drinking buddy said he was when drunk in college, and evasive and non-responsive. Dr. Ford's allegations were credible enough to get her here before the Senate. Her testimony here was quiet, open, and powerful. She was calm, composed, and utterly believable. Even President Trump called her testimony credible and compelling. So did many of my Republican colleagues. But then came the smear campaign to discredit and demean her, led by the president's sickening taunts and mockery in Mississippi. Then came the majority leader's criticisms. He knew it wouldn't do to say outright she lied. But his every accusation fell to pieces if she was telling the truth. His attacks were a bank shot, a relentless, indirect bank shot smear of Dr. Ford's credibility. One element of the smear of Dr. Blasey Ford was to describe her testimony as uncorroborated. We've heard that over and over. The majority leader said that again just this morning on the floor. Uncorroborated. Well, first, that just isn't true. Prior, consistent statements are a well-known form of corroboration. And Dr. Ford's prior, consistent statements are abundant. And it is ironic to have Republicans complain about a lack of corroboration when Republicans did everything possible to prevent corroborating evidence from coming forward. It is deeply unfair to Dr. Ford to disallow prevent, and freeze out corroborating evidence and then call her testimony uncorroborated. Which brings us to the, to put it politely, abridged FBI investigation. First, the FBI background investigation was closed to this new evidence in an unprecedented break from the entire history of background investigations. Then, the investigation was limited by secret orders from the White House. We still have not seen. What do we see? We see the dozens of credible, percipient, and corroborating witnesses who came forward to say they couldn't get an interview from the FBI, who were never contacted when they made themselves known to the FBI. I ask unanimous consent that two letters from the representatives of Ms. Ramirez and Dr. Ford explaining this be added at the end of my remarks.
Without objection.
Many witnesses were fobbed off into a black hole of a tip line from which no tip appears ever to have been pursued, a tip line that was just a dumping ground for unwelcome evidence. As United States Attorney, had I received the set of witness summaries we saw, I would have sent the package back for more investigation. A sincere and thorough investigation designed to get at the truth would have broadly interviewed Kavanaugh and Blasey Ford's known contemporaries to probe their recollections. An investigation designed to get at the truth would have interviewed the witnesses who corroborated Dr. Blasey Ford's prior consistent statements. An investigation designed to get at the truth would have tested Kavanaugh's calendar and yearbook entries with contemporaneous witnesses. An investigation designed to get at the truth would have done interviews of witnesses who corroborate the incident alleged by Ms. Ramirez, like the classmate, and I quote, 100% sure he was told at the time that Kavanaugh exposed himself to Ramirez. 100% sure. An investigation designed to get at the truth would have interviewed people who recalled Kavanaugh's propensity to drink to excess and his behavior when drunk relevant to these incidents. An investigation designed to get at the truth would have certainly sought to interview the alleged victims like Christine Blasey Ford and the accused perpetrator, Brett Kavanaugh. From public reporting, we know that none of this happened. It is difficult to escape the conclusion that, like everything else in this nomination, like hiding 90% of the records from the Bush White House days, like putting bogus executive privilege cover over other documents, like claiming documents are committee confidential through a non-existent process that was partisan from start to finish, like everything else, it is hard to escape the conclusion that this investigation was designed not to get at the truth, but to step carefully around it. I am a huge fan of the FBI. I admire that organization immensely. And it must have killed the agents to do such a half-baked and incomplete job because of marching orders from the White House. My heart goes out to the experienced FBI professionals hamstrung by the Trump White House through this investigation. They know better than anyone the holes in what they did. But in this matter, they don't have the independence of a criminal investigation. The White House is the client. They must do what they are told. This was yet another Trump abuse of a proud American institution. So here we are. A defendant in a criminal prosecution enjoys a presumption of innocence until proven guilty. A defendant in a civil trial must be found culpable by a preponderance of the evidence. an executive agency must make decisions based on substantial evidence. But the question before us is none of those. The question before us is whether Brett Kavanaugh is a man with the character, credibility, impartiality, and temperament to sit in judgment on America's highest court. We now know Brett Kavanaugh is not that. He is not close. And Americans know it. But the big Republican interest groups don't care because they see that 91%, and they yearn for 73 more 5-4 partisan victories. Service to the law has at its heart an earnest pursuit of the truth. In Kavanaugh's pursuit of office, truth has too often been not his goal, but his casualty. The history of falsehoods is well chronicled. Denying that he worked on the nomination of the controversial Judge Pryor, denying that he knew of documents stolen from Judiciary Committee Democrats when he was at the Bush White House, denying that he was involved in questions about the secret detention program or the controversial warrantless wiretapping program, denying what he himself said about presidential immunity from investigation, and complicit in the cover-up of millions of documents we should have seen, and on and on. Once Dr. Blasey Ford and then Ms. Ramirez came forward with sexual assault allegations, the lies came fast and furiously that he knew nothing about the Ramirez allegations until the New Yorker story was published, that he had no alcohol problem and had never drunk to the point of impairment of his memory, that he had unique definitions of phrases in common parlance related to binge drinking and sex, that he always treated women with dignity and respect, and that claiming himself as a girl's alumnus was a sign of affection. As the woman herself retorted, there is nothing affectionate or respectful in bragging about making sexual conquests that never happened. End quote. On they came, little lies and big lies about not having connections to get into Yale, about honoring grand jury secrecy while helping the Ken Starr investigation. None perhaps individually fatal, but together adding up to a pattern of dissembling and prevarication. Even before Kavanaugh was nominated, Leader McConnell smelled trouble and urged the president not to nominate someone he knew was a badly flawed nominee with a lengthy paper trail that would likely disclose how extreme and partisan Judge Kavanaugh truly is. So much has been left by the wayside in the mad rush to jam this nomination through. Documents, facts, Senate rules and traditions, real investigation, simple respect for truth, all smashed up wreckage in the wake of this nomination. But as my fellow New Englander John Adams said, facts are stubborn things. The truth has a way of coming out. The millions of hidden pages of Kavanaugh's White House records will come out. The non-assertion assertions of executive privilege will fall or yield to time. The unheard witnesses will ultimately be heard, and others may come forward. Which brings me back to that question I began with. Why all the wreckage? Why all the rush? Why all the damage? Why all the violation? The answer is in the numbers. 5-4, 73, and 91%. At the end of the day, we go back to a Supreme Court far too often dancing to the tune of a handful of big Republican special interests. The record of this, the pattern of this, is undeniable. And as I said, it will be a disaster for the court, and Kavanaugh will eagerly contribute to that disaster. This whole mess has been a dark episode for the United States Senate, for the Supreme Court, for our image around the world, for our democracy. But there is one bright jewel that can be picked from the midst of all the filth and wreckage and lies. That is that something very special is happening out there. The testimony of Dr. Christine Blasey Ford, of her assault at the hands of Brett Kavanaugh, though studiously ignored by so many Republicans and mocked by the President of the United States, has lit a fire. Just in my small state of Rhode Island, at least 10 women have written to me to share their own personal stories of survival of sexual assault. Like all of us, I get mail every day about various policies that are being debated here in the Senate. I'm coming up on 12 years. I've never had mail like this. These women have come forward from widely different ages and backgrounds, college students and grandmothers, to tell their stories. Some had held these secrets close for years, even for decades. Several of these women gave me permission to share their words. Words they have allowed me to free here on the Senate floor after years of silence. What a privilege it is. What an honor for me to be trusted in this way by these remarkable women. Some were moved to tell their stories because they see their own fears reflected in Dr. Blasey Ford's brave testimony. The fear of not being believed, the fear of losing the respect of family or of friends. But they knew that Dr. Blasey Ford's memories were real. And they told me they wanted me to trust that Dr. Blasey Ford's memories were real because they knew that their own memories were real. Because their own memories of their assault were seared into their minds. One told me, "I am Dr. Ford." A woman wrote to me, "I'm sure my rapist hasn't thought of me since that night 21 years ago either. In fact, he, like Kavanaugh, would likely deny anything had ever happened. But here's the thing about rape. The victims never forget." The coverage of Dr. Blasey Ford's appearance before the Senate for some stirred deep and disquieting emotions. One woman wrote, "The past few weeks have been doubly difficult. With Dr. Ford coming forward, and all of the constant news threads and social media threads, I have been triggered with nightmares, fear of being alone, and emotionally wrecked. PTSD and triggers are real. No matter how much therapy and time goes by, one small statement or physical interaction can trigger someone who has experienced a traumatic assault." One letter read, "As a rape survivor, I was 19 years old. I am now 66 years old. I want you to know that that experience does color the rest of a person's life, informing decisions that you make, where and how you go somewhere, how you raise your children and relate to your husband and all other people. Sometimes through the decades, you think about it consciously and on purpose. And sometimes outside events can bring it back without your willing it to be so. Dr. Blasey Ford's quietly compelling testimony has forced our nation to face up to tough questions about how women have been treated. The redemption, if there is one, for this foul nomination process is for us to grasp the power of this moment, for our country to act on the power of this moment. This is about far more than a troubled and troubling nominee. Something big is happening. Women across the country, like these extraordinary women in Rhode Island, are reconciling with their truth, fighting through a long and deeply unfair legacy of shame and fear and stigma, and they're stepping up. They're coming forward, determined, as one wrote to me, to leave a different world for their daughters and granddaughters than the world that silenced them for years, for decades. For me, Mr. President, it is a true personal honor to share this moment with them, to be trusted with these long-held stories, to have the chance to help end that bitterly unfair legacy, and to support them toward that new and better world for their daughters and granddaughters. I yield the floor.
That was a rather impassioned speech made just yesterday on the floor of the Senate by Rhode Island Senator Sheldon Whitehouse. We have some time left, and we can take a couple of your calls at 888-874-4888. Obviously, we'll continue discussing this tomorrow, but we have some time now where we can get a couple of questions in before we sign off. What was the most telling thing to you that you heard in the speech today? There's one word, and it continues to pop up in my brain. One word. I wondered whether it occurred to you, this one word. But even if it did not, what was your reaction, or what is your reaction to Senator Whitehouse's speech? Ma'at, you're on the air.
Yes. Greetings to the beloved family.
Thank you.
Yes, he's right on target. And what I also suggest you play is at the hearing itself, he gave a piece. He talked, he started out with the calendar, and he basically was making the point that the people that Dr. Ford had mentioned were lined up there. And he also said that he started out saying that Kavanaugh was not credible, and he said he was dodging and dissembling, ranting and raving, and filibustering and prevaricating. So that's a shorter piece, so maybe you could play that also for the family. I tell you, we're in such crisis in terms of where this country is. let me attach what I heard yesterday of John Kasich. He's a Republican in I believe it's Ohio. And I think he's was governor or something along those lines, and also in the Congress.
He was governor.
Yes. And he was talking about, because it's almost beyond belief that instead of Trump calming things down and taking his victory lap, he's doubled on, you know. He's called Blasey evil and just said things that are absolutely not true, that Kavanaugh was proven innocent and all. But he made the point that he used Churchill's example that when you have a victory, that should have you be magnanimous. And, of course, any idea of Trump being magnanimous on any level is just the opposite of his baby man self. But he likes to, I guess, throw fuel on the fire, and he said it should not be a zero sum. You know, you win, and you should not vanquish people, basically to the point of plummeting, but, you know, do it with grace. And
but the
jury
is still out on whether he won. It is clear that he rammed his candidate through. But I think we got a very good perspective on that word "win," and the question as Senator Whitehouse said, why? Thanks so much for getting us.
Yes, thank you.
Today. Thank you, Jeff from New Jersey. What are your thoughts on what you heard?
Well, what I heard, it was a day late and a dollar short. That should have been the argument all along, as far as his qualifications for having a job and his temperament for having the job. You know, so I believe that he's not qualified. The speech is wonderful, but I still have a bit of aggravation about it. And a bit of aggravation of these heroic women that are coming forth and explaining that they're survivors of sexual assault, and being from an African American background, the history is a lot more painful for us. This is
we're not doing a comparative analysis to discuss who suffered more. We should take each case in its own context, but I understand where you're going with it. Here's a question. Mm-hmm. Was there a particular word that still troubles you from his speech?
Couldn't think of one. Like I said, I had a bit of an aggravation, and again, this...
You're aggravated today.
Well, it's aggravating on a couple of levels because, you know, this should have been the argument and not the the real concrete stuff should have been the argument and the thing that he held up. But what also bothers me is again, he's claiming the man is guilty, and I'm not a Kavanaugh fan, of course, but he's claiming the man is guilty, and we don't have that solid concrete proof. Is still one word against another. And, you know, I think we could have gotten it, but again, the investigation was blocked, so on and so forth. But no, not a, I'm missing that word that you're thinking of. So,
the word I'm thinking of that screamed at me is the word partisan. And that means this is not just a Republican problem. In all of the statistics that he talked about, the 5-4 decisions, these are all partisan decisions, he said. The 73 decisions that came down in favor of the power elite, the 91% of the times that Kavanaugh voted in favor when he was on the circuit court, in favor of big business and the power elite. According to White House, Sheldon Whitehouse, a senator, he used the word partisan. And that means that there are Democrats mixed up in this too.
Well, I've
it was not just a Republican problem.
Well, that's one of the things that I think we have to really, really come to terms with. Uh-huh. We have to come to terms with the fact that the Democrats have not been liberal since Bill Clinton, that they moved to the center while the Tea Party, they moved to the center right, while the Tea Party moved the Republican Party to the very far extreme right. So we don't have a liberal party, unless it's the Green Party or someone else. We don't have any liberals left in politics. They're either conservative or ultra-conservative, which means they're either pro-business or super pro-business, you know, on steroids. We don't have, we have to really come to terms with that. You know, the liberals, you know, we can no longer call the chair a liberal. You know, it's
so that is some work. That is some work we have to do. That is something worth discussing as a topic all by itself. But yeah. I mean, it kind of, if you weren't paying attention to it, it would have gone right over your head, right? But it's a very important word. He kept calling it partisan.
That's one of the things that kind of, when I talk about this speech, it was a day late and a dollar short, was that the non-defense or the non-prosecution or aggressiveness of the Democrats gave them permission.
This was not his first speech, to be fair. This was not his first speech, but it was, to my mind, a very comprehensive speech.
It was,
and
I think it
tackled several different areas that we routinely dismiss when we talk about subjects like this of the appointment of persons to the U.S. Supreme Court. Well, thank you, Lisa. I'm so sorry that you can't get in today, but certainly we'll pick up tomorrow. Thank you all for listening and contributing, and hopefully this program today would fuel our further discussions tomorrow. Bye-bye. Thank you.